You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Almost by accident, Homeland Security Special Agent Remedio Viola and Prosecutor Bonnie Kapler stumbled upon Colombia's biggest, baddest, and previously undetected drug operation. After they found it, they worked methodically side by side for 12 years until the dangerous organization, which came to be known as the Norte Valle Cartel, was rendered completely powerless. How they did it is documented by best-selling author Jeffrey Robinson in The Takedown, which is published by Tom Dunn Books. And I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Robinson and Special Agent Viola to our show today.
Nice to see you.
Before we get into the story here, Remedio, why do all your colleagues call you Rooney?
It's a dumb nickname that my brother gave me a long time ago, growing up in Brooklyn, because he felt like Romedio was too sophisticated a name for the streets of Brooklyn.
So would you prefer I call you Remedio
or Rumi? Either or, it's fine.
So let's get to this case. Everything began when you heard about three small money wiring agencies in New York City back in 1996. Who told you about them?
Actually, we came to it through documentary evidence that we had found, which indicated that the three companies were what we call structuring transactions, and it led us to starting to investigate them because of they were bringing in tremendous amounts of cash and structuring all of them below the reporting requirement amount, so that we started doing surveillance on the store. We found nobody came into the store. Very few people came into the store, and yet they were generating a lot of cash out of the store.
When you say we, this is before Homeland Security was created. You
Yes.
wound up being an agent with Homeland Security. So who were you working for then?
I was a customs agent, and El Dorado, the El Dorado Task Force, was a combination of IRS, customs, NYPD, the state police. A lot of agencies working together, specifically targeting money laundering cases.
And where were these agencies located in the city?
One was in Forest Hills on Austin Street. The second one was on Broadway in Astoria. And the last one was on Junction Boulevard in Corona, all in Queens.
Mm-hmm. And Queens, because there's a large Colombian presence in Queens?
Yes, that would be safe to say.
Now, Jeffrey, I mentioned Romedio being called Rooney. Didn't the members of this cartel have some interesting nicknames as well?
Oh, they sure did. One of them, Archangel, had lost his arm as a child, and he was called El Mocho, which I think is the amputee. And,
Mocho.
Mocho, yeah. And Rascuño, Bustamante, had a scar. And that's how I think he got his nickname.
Yes.
But typical
scar
typical,
meaning scratch.
Scratch, yeah, but typical of the mafia, you know, Louis the Vest, and these people, they all have nicknames because that's what gangsters do.
So what were these wiring agencies doing that was illegal?
Well,
there's an awful lot of cash going through them that was unexplained.
It was drug cash. That's what they were doing illegally. They were remitting the money back to three towns in Colombia that no one had ever heard of. This wasn't going to Cali. It wasn't going to Bogota. It wasn't going to Medellin. It was going to Manizales, Pereira, and Armenia. And the interesting thing was that after Bonnie Clapper got, as the prosecutor, got the warrant that got Rooney and the rest of the guys inside the wire remitters, and they shut them down, basically the Justice Department and then Customs said, okay, that's fine, now move on to the next one. And what happened, which was so unique, was that Bonnie and Remedio said, well, wait a minute, you know what? Why are they going to these three towns that no one ever heard of? If it was going to Cali or Medellin or Bogota, we'd understand, but what are these three towns? So while the rest of the task force moved on to other remitters to follow the money and shut down this connection, these two, working out of Hopag in Central Islip, way out on Long Island, said, let's find out why these three towns are important.
But it's interesting that Bonnie Clapper is in the story. Was she your first choice?
Yes, she was actually the only choice.
But didn't a lot of other people say, I don't even want to get involved? This doesn't seem interesting.
No, I wouldn't say it was uninteresting. I would say that it was sort of uncharted territory at the time. And nobody, because of the location of where the money was going and the nature of the case being a money case, starting out as a money case, there wasn't a lot of interest in it initially. We had closed down the three stores, and like Jeffrey said, we had moved on to other stores. But this one lingered because what happened was, as the case developed early on, we started developing information from workers in the store and informants that, in fact, led us back to
Cartago.
The area of Cartago, the town of Cartago in Colombia, which is a small little town in the northern part of the state of Valle, hence the name Norte Valle.
Although even to this day, this is an unfamiliar name to me. Of course, I know Cali and Medellin, and yet you say that at one point they were dealing 60% of the cocaine that was coming in.
Well, that's what happened. You see, when Escobar was killed and the action moved to Cali, the Orihuela brothers, whom I know you know about because I know you did the interview with Bill Rempel, who's an old friend, the Cali cartel was General Motors. That's how they structured themselves. And they, because they were businessmen as opposed to the Hollywood star that Pablo thought he was, the two Orihuela brothers said, you know what, we have a problem. We're getting loads that are intercepted. We're losing money. So instead of the General Motors model that they had started with, they transformed themselves into McDonald's. And they took that model and they said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to franchise. And they started selling their cocaine to these 300 mini cartels and said, look, you pay us. If you get stuck getting the drugs into America, that's your problem, not ours, pal. We get the money. One of these groups of about, I don't know, five, six, seven desperado criminals, miserable bastards, in Cartago, professional thieves and gangsters, formed a cartel amongst themselves in the true sense of the word cartel, sharing loads and doing joint ventures and forming strategic alliances. And little by little, over the course of a few years, they took over all of the other little cartels. And this Norte Valle bunch was responsible for 60% of all the drugs coming into the United States.
Well, I can see why a cartel might be effective, but I also understand why the franchise model might be a good way to go, because if somebody gets caught, it doesn't bring down the whole operation. Why do we why do we wind up seeing again and again the development of these huge organizations?
Well, you don't find the cartels. Escobar was not a cartel in the true sense. Neither were the Orihuela brothers in Cali. But this bunch in Cartago, which is near the three cities where the money was being sent, they formed a real cartel the way OPEC forms cartels with the various countries.
It was basically like different families almost that you have in the mafia. Mm-hmm. That developed.
Yeah, exactly.
And they all agreed to work together.
They work together. I mean, in the case of this cartel, I mean, one day they'd be best of friends and the next day they could be worst of enemies. I mean, alliances shift very readily and very quickly in this world. But what you had was a series of five or six individuals who basically ran their own organization. But like Jeffrey said, they shared loads with other families. They shared profits. They shared laboratories. They shared
girlfriends, and they shared sisters, and they shared wives. This is like the five families in New York.
But the five families in New York would be at each other's throats at times and start killing each other.
As were they. I mean, we're talking about a group that might have been responsible for as many as 10,000 deaths. These are not nice people.
No.
Let's get back to a nice person.
Not an
nice
understatement.
To Bonnie. Yeah. Bonnie was not only a U.S. attorney, but she was also a suburban housewife who would bake cookies for criminals.
Yeah, only when she came to like them a little bit. Not initially. She had to evaluate them first and then see if they warranted cookies or not.
So were cookies really enough to persuade a dangerous drug trafficker to give
information? No, it was simply icing on the cake, I guess you could call it, in a way. Bonnie has a great way of endearing herself to these folks and getting them to trust her, because she's very fair, she's very straightforward, and once they did, they would be very truthful. Not all the time, never 100% of the time, or occasionally 100% of the time, but to degrees, varying degrees, but she had a way of endearing herself to them.
Well, the FBI says that the best way to get information is not to torture somebody, but to become friends. And that was her approach.
Yes. Well, that was their approach. They yeah. treated these
your,
people.
Your, the
yeah, both of them. They oh. treated these people like human beings as opposed to dogs and criminals. For example.
You've never waterboarded anybody?
No, never. Slap somebody on the wrist. That's about it.
Well, for example, a lot of the attorneys, and you find this all over the country, will do their proffers, their interviews with criminals in the morning, send them back to jail around lunchtime so that the attorneys can go out and have their own lunch. What Bonnie and Remedio did often was do the proffers in the middle of the morning. And they'd get to lunchtime, and they would say to these people, remember, these are people who had everything for a while, lots of money, lots of women, lots of everything, and have suddenly been denied everything because they're living in a prison cell somewhere. Bad food, no access, they can't do anything. And Bonnie and Remedio would say to them, look, instead of sending you back to jail at lunch, why don't we send out for some Colombian food? And often Remedio would have to pay for it out of his own pocket. But that would endear these men to these two. And these guys said, look, these are the only two people who really care about me. I'll cooperate.
Because the guys back home weren't doing anything to get them out?
Well, in some cases, there were death threats. I mean, there were some serious players involved. And they were protected. How long were you? 3 months?
Yeah, for 3 months we had 24/7 protection due to threats made by one of the last individuals that we arrested in the in the case, a fellow by the name of Carlos Patino Restrepo.
Except I have to tell the secret. Leonard, I'm going to tell you the secret. They had protection. Now, the marshals came into Bonnie's office and said, you're coming with us. And she said, I'm busy. She said, no. We're not asking. This is not an invitation. You're coming with us. Either you're going to get up and walk out or we're going to carry you out. There's been a serious death threat. You're going to be protected. They moved into Bonnie's house. And what does Bonnie do? Well, her husband immediately gets an extra sports channel so these guys can watch reruns of baseball at night. When they go out to dinner, they take him out to dinner. They follow Bonnie, and they become part of the family. In Remedio's case, his attitude was, look, I don't want protection, and I've got other important things to do. I've got to go buy gourmet food for my cats. And they would say things like, look, why don't you just buy a week's worth? He said, don't get involved with my cats. I buy fresh for them every day, and I don't need you. I have a gun. So Remedio and his car would be all over New York City buying gourmet cat food while Security guys would be following him.
It wasn't the best of times for one. It's an invasion of privacy, to put it mildly. It really is a hard thing to take. I'd never faced it before, 24/7 protection. And your life becomes their life. You know, you become – and it's an odd thing to try to deal with. And Bonnie dealt with it much better than I did, I must say.
But you're a cop being protected by cops. It's different than
for sure.
A U.S. attorney being protected by cops.
And the threat was real, by the way. I mean, someone had paid apparently $1 million to somebody. The gun was already in Brooklyn.
But there was never any real attempt?
Well, what happened was the man who took the contract was stopped at Bogota Airport and was interviewed. They had no reason to hold him, but they said, we know who you are and you're not boarding the plane for Spain. He was going to fly Colombian Airways to Madrid, change his passport there, and get us an Iberia flight to New York. They stopped him from doing that, but he took the $1 million. So he now becomes a target. So he's apparently disappeared, and the fellow who put out the contract is now doing very serious time in a federal prison.
My guests are Jeffrey Robinson, whose previous bestsellers are on international organized crime and dirty money, including The Laundryman, The Merger, and The Sink. He's written a book called The Takedown, A Suburban Mom, A Coal Miner's Son, and The Unlikely Demise of Colombia's Brutal Norte Valle Cartel, which is published by St. Martin's Press. And also with us is that coal miner's son, Remedio Viola. We'll take a little break and come back with more. We're back with Remedio Viola, one of the subjects of a new book by Jeffrey Robinson called The Takedown. It is published by Thomas Dunn imprint of St. Martin's Press. So all of this starts years before the creation of Homeland Security. How does Homeland Security come into this? And were drugs even the purview of Homeland Security, which was created to fight terrorism, wasn't it?
Yes, you're exactly right. It was inherited. I mean, the case started well before Homeland Security came into existence. And we just carried it forward as a money laundering case, basically, through. We still have Homeland Security still investigates money laundering cases. El Dorado still does what it's been doing for the last 20 years.
So all of the different agencies that might have dealt with drug dealing were merged under Homeland Security in the hopes of getting all of the FBI, the CIA, the DEA, et cetera, to work together and share resources. So were they sharing resources?
No, actually, to the contrary. The FBI and DEA and the CIA were left outside of Homeland Security. Immigration, Customs, Secret Service merged into Homeland Security as a somewhat of a reaction to 9/11. And where Bush decided to make it into one agency to oversee all of supposedly terrorist activities. But in point of fact, it still falls to the FBI and the CIA to a large extent.
And is there more cooperation now than there was in the past?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say within the Department of Homeland Security, there is for sure. I mean, because the agencies merged. Immigration, there's more of a flow of information immigration-wise with the old customs agency. Yeah, I would say so.
So you had no problem. There were never any instances where other agencies kept information that would have been helpful to you and Bonnie.
Well, agencies are territorial by nature. And I wouldn't say it was always a very free flow of information. But generally, we actually did have a lot of cooperation with, I'd have to say, with DEA, with the FBI, the people that we worked with that were related to other targets within the Norte Valle. The flow of information was fairly fluid.
How did 9/11 complicate the investigation? Weren't your offices in World Trade 6?
Yeah. Well, a lot of the evidence that we had up to that point was stored there. And with the demise of the towers, you know, all the evidence went down with it. So it was sort of starting, you know, from scratch in a way.
Obviously that was difficult, but all you had is your memory of what you had.
To a large extent. Yeah, we still had, you know, interview records, stuff like that. The actual documents from the agencies and all the paper went up in flame.
But there was cash there and there were weapons there and people had to go back in and get that stuff out.
The computer information is in other computers, isn't it?
Yeah, there were backup computers, and we managed to get those out. Those were actually salvaged.
Now, how did this group get the name Norte Valle Cartel? Did they name themselves that?
It's a good question.
Well, they're in the North Valley.
It's basically, geography.
But, I mean, they called themselves that. For example, for years there was a big discussion over whether we should call organized crime in America the Mafia or Cosa Nostra.
Cosa Nostra. Right.
Well, Cosa Nostra is what they call themselves,
yes,
meaning our thing. But in this case, when they discovered the three cities, Manizales, Armenia, and Pereira, I think it was Bonnie who said to the man who actually owned the remitters, I think she said to him, a man named Monsalve, said to him, oh, so this is the Manzales, Armenia, Pereira cartel. And he was the one who said, no, it's the Norte del Valle cartel.
So that's the first time you even found out that there was such a thing?
Yes, first time I had ever heard of it.
Did they only traffic cocaine or were they selling other drugs as well?
There was heroin involved in it, but I would say predominantly 90-95% of everything that we investigated involved cocaine.
How did they get it into the country?
Well, in a number of ways. They were the ones who opened up the Mexican connection. They romance the Mexicans to carry product.
I guess we can thank them for that.
Yeah, we can thank them for that because obviously when they fell, the action moved to Mexico, which is what we see now in a narco-civil war in Mexico.
Right. Are there any Colombian cartels even doing much anymore, or is it all Mexicans just going to
Oh, no, there are still Colombians. Colombians because the product is there.
Yeah.
But then these guys opened up the submarine trade and the submersibles.
They built a submarine?
Well, that's where you first find them. I mean, the history of the submarine is quite an interesting one. There was a Russian guy in Miami who thought he could get access when the Soviet Union fell to some submarines. And he tried to sell the idea to the Colombians. And the money was paid, and it didn't work out because the Colombians said, well, how are we going to get the submarine from Russia to Colombia? And they said, well, we'll tow it. And they said, well, don't you think the U.S. Navy will eventually say, What is that? So they said no. And what they did was, again, because this is a business, what they did was what Dell Computer does. Dell doesn't send their computers from Texas to England. They build in England. So what the Colombians did was import Russian engineers to build them a submarine in Colombia.
And did that work?
Yes, it did. And now you find submersibles, a lot of them, coming from the, what is it, the west coast of Colombia. Up the west coast of the United States.
But they were also smuggling stuff in much less sophisticated ways, stuffed inside air conditioners and stuff like that.
Yeah, the air conditioners were mainly used actually to bring money back to Colombia. But as far as the shipment of drugs, a lot of it was by fast boats at this time, where they would launch fast boats routinely with 1,200, 1,400 kilos at a time to the coast of Mexico from the north coast of Colombia. They would do it through via fishing boats. Many times they would carry drugs that way. That was one of the predominant ways was by – way back when. I mean, when it started, it was a lot by air. But the air traffic sort of died out, I'd say, in the mid-90s because too many planes were getting caught. So they reversed and went to water.
So how did you get most of this information? From the people you were questioning?
It was – the whole case was essentially driven by informants.
Could you trust what they were telling you?
To varying degrees. It's like what we referenced before. There are ones that you can trust more than others. You sort of have to gauge it as you go along. You know, some don't tell you a damn bit of truth at the beginning and later become your best cooperators. Others tell you half the truth all the time and never come across with the other half. So,
well, I'd imagine that they would be a little afraid. Didn't one famous cartel require that anyone who wanted to get involved provide a Rolodex of his family members' information?
Yes, yes.
And, I mean, we know where your cousin lives.
We know where your mother lives. And there were instances. In fact, one of the women who had worked at one of the remitters in the original part of the case ended up not only killed but driven over by a truck. I mean,
they must have been nervous about what might happen to them.
Oh, sure. A lot of people were very, very scared. Very, very scared. The other thing is, in dealing with the Colombian authorities, Remedio and Bonnie had to decide to what degree do you trust the people you're dealing with, because you could trust some of them 50%, but you couldn't trust all of them all of the time.
Because many of them had been bribed.
Yeah, corruption is rampant, I'd say.
And many of the Norte Valle people, like Wilbur Varela, were former policemen. They had defected from the cops into the cartels.
It's a training ground for a lot of traffickers. They start as policemen. Orlando Hanau did, Varela did, Patino did. A lot of them, that's how they get their initial start in the drug trade.
Could you bring endangered family members to the United States and protect them?
I call it Rooney's Ark, because Noah's Ark, that's what he did.
Yes, many, many, many. We brought a lot through a system in immigration called paroles to get them out of harm's way. Or as if they were informants, we brought them for to be debriefed and all. But we brought quite a number, I'd say.
Remedio Viola is my guest. He was a special agent with Homeland Security and worked with Prosecutor Bonnie Kepler on a case to bring down the Norte Valle cartel, which was bringing 60% of all the cocaine coming into the United States at one point. The book written by Jeffrey Robinson about that is called The Takedown, A Suburban Mom, A Coal Miner's Son, and The Unlikely Demise of Colombia's Brutal Norte Valle Cartel. It is published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. I'm Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Is it important for us to know that you're a coal miner's son? You sound like a Brooklyn boy to me.
Yeah, well, I am by and large a Brooklyn boy. I came up when I was 2. My father, who was in fact a coal miner, moved out of West Virginia, thankfully, and brought the family to Brooklyn. But no, it's not important. It just makes for a good title, I think.
We mentioned that this was really dangerous for these people involved. If it was so dangerous, why did they get involved? Was the money just that good?
Well, you're talking about humongous amounts of money. I mean, if you have a ton of drugs, that translates to a ton of street cash. I mean, if you figure that $1 million in $100 bills weighs about 22 to 24 pounds and stacks 12 feet high or 10 feet high. 22 pounds, you're talking about what's a ton? That suddenly becomes 2,000 pounds. So you're talking about, do the math.
And 100 times that.
Yeah, 100 times that. And 1,000 times that, isn't it? I don't know.
I was never good at math.
20 times 20, 100 is 2,000.
2,000, anyway. You're right. Yeah, okay, so it's 100 times
it's
that.
A lot.
And so you're talking about $100 million per ton.
Now, Monsalvo, the man who you mentioned earlier who was in charge of wiring agencies that were illegally transferring the money to Colombia, told the judge that he started trafficking because of extreme poverty that he experienced growing up. Did that sway the judge?
In his case,
no.
Not at all.
No. Not in Monsalvo was one of the, what shall we say, not one of the nicer people you'll come across in life. And no, it didn't sway the judge. I think she said something to the effect of, paraphrasing, you're one of the worst individual who has ever been brought before me.
Yeah, he was responsible for a number of very brutal murders, heartless murders. I mean, this was a terrible
two in Queens, day. Actually, that we had indicted him for.
Did the traffickers ever use the Nuremberg defense that they were just following orders?
I don't think they did. No, you see, what Bonnie and Remedio did was get them to cooperate and plead guilty. So there were very few trials. These people came up and they pled guilty to the charges and went away for however long, and in many cases, life without the possibility of parole.
You mentioned Monsalve being evil. A lot of these men were evil, weren't they? I mean, one of them purposely told his driver to run over a dog on the side of the road just for sport.
These are terrible people whose sense of the world is completely distorted by the amounts of money that they suddenly find themselves with. Because they can have anything, buy anything. I mean, in Cartago, when Gomez Bustamante was really running the show, you could not drive into Cartago or get into the town without being spotted by one of his people. He had people all night long on every street corner to report who the foreigners were. That takes a lot of money.
Yes.
So in doing this, you said, Remedio, you couldn't trust people in Colombia. But what about higher-ups in the Colombian government? Were they cooperative?
To varying degrees. There's a systemic problem with corruption in Colombia and people being paid off to hide information or to give false information, depending on what the case may be. So everything you have to – all the information you receive, you have to deal with it through a filter of sorts and sort of go with your best – sometimes just your best instincts.
There are even things that you have to know that I would never know, like whether to get into a white or a yellow taxi cab.
That's something I found in Bogota that really freaked me out. A lot of people like Colombia and are very comfortable there. I know Remedio likes it and Bonnie likes it. I found myself paranoid, completely paranoid, maybe because of what I was doing there. But apparently there are two different kinds of taxi cabs in Bogota, and one of them is assigned to the hotel, so they know who the driver is. And I think that's the white one. The yellow one's the one you get on the street, and you don't know who the driver is. And every week, bodies are found in front of ATM machines because the drivers take you to the ATM machine. Their brother-in-law comes out and says, empty it.
But in your case, Remedio, you and Bonnie even had your names printed in a newspaper.
Yes.
They're famous.
Infamous.
You still like going there?
Sure. It's a beautiful country. I mean, people are very nice, and I enjoyed it. I've been there 8 or 10 times now.
The members of the cartel go to extreme measures to hide from people like you. One even had extensive plastic surgery done.
Yes, Mr. Abadia, Mr. Chupeta.
Yeah,
had
Chupeta.
More than extensive. I don't know. It's Michael Jackson level of plastic surgery, I'd say. If you saw pictures of when he started and when he finished, it's quite traumatic.
And talk about nicknames. Chupeta means lollipop. This is a grown man called Lollipop.
Do we know why? No. Can we say it on the air?
I have no idea. But he had extensive plastic surgery and was hiding in Brazil until he got caught and then shipped back to the States immediately.
Remedio, haven't you retired?
Yes.
Was it because the takedown of one of the world's biggest drug cartels seemed like a fitting end to a career?
No, it was age-related. I turned 50. 57 is mandatory for agents to retire, and I turned 57. So I was.
Why so young? You probably knew a lot more than the 20-year-olds who are entering the agency.
The lay of the land. It's just the the rule, 57 and you go. So,
but you're still working with Bonnie as a contract.
No, I worked for a year afterwards helping to prepare for the Patino trial. And that ended in April, thankfully, with his conviction. And now I'm retired.
Just one more thing. Did the takedown of the Norte Valle cartel reduce the amount of drugs coming into this country?
It did for a while, but what happens is it simply displaces it. Like money laundering, you stop it and then it moves someplace else. It's water seeking its own level. What it did, however, do was prove that two people with a pipe dream, if they spend 15 years and work at it, can actually get a result, and it's nice when the good guys win.
Could you do something similar with the Mexican cartels, or are they just too dangerous?
No, you could do the same thing, but you'd need a lot more cooperation from the Mexicans, and the Mexicans are a different level.
Remedio Viola is one of the two subjects of Jeffrey Robinson's new book called The Takedown. It's published by St. Martin's Press and the Thomas Dunn Books imprint. Thank you so much.
Great to see you. Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you.